Welcome to the Surviving Society collaborative and ongoing series with Sage Publishing's Social Science for Social Justice book series. This series reflects Sage's mission-driven approach to publishing by platforming emerging voices and enabling the dissemination of bold thinking that will inform the work of future generations of scholars and changemakers. In these episodes, we talk to authors from the book series about their research embedded in visions for social justice for all.
This book is based on a critical understanding of the loaded nature of the notion of normal life in the UK, including how ideas about normality and togetherness are invoked in ways that reflect forms of structural oppression and promote specific socio-political perspectives, which are repackaged as universal experiences. By focusing on the relationship and schism between care, commodification, and the COVID-19 crisis, I grapple with how notions of normal life function as part of the porous and potent dynamics between people, profit, places, pandemics, and politics. Who and what is deemed to be normal, and who and what is framed as a contrasting other? Who and what determines this, and why? How are ideas about normal life constructed in consumer culture during times of crisis? Normal is not a neutral concept. The days, months, and years before the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic are often nostalgically referred to as being part of the normal life that many people long to return to. Whose perceptions of normal life are foregrounded in current discourse concerning crisis and a so-called good time before COVID-19? What does examining these matters reveal about experiences and a lack of care and comfort? These questions are at the core of this book, which examines elements of the UK's media and marketing landscape, including their entanglements with messages of empowerment, multiculturalism, and nationalism.
Welcome to another episode of Surviving Society. I am really excited today to be in conversation with Dr. Francesca Sabande. We are going to be talking today about her latest book with Sage Publications, Consuming Crisis, Commodifying Care and COVID-19. Now, Francesca, as you all know, is Surviving Society alumni. She's also such a huge inspiration to me as a Black feminist scholar, someone that writes about culture, media, commodification, Black feminist methodologies, so much incredible, innovative work that is really, really integral to how we're imagining freedom and life as Black people in this, do we want to say the 21st century or this next season? I always see your work as, yeah, bringing me kind of inspiration and imagination. And I think at its heart, your work, and this book does this, is it's truly interdisciplinary. Thank you so much for coming on today, Francesca.
Thank you, and thank you for such a generous introduction. And the pleasure is all mine to be here with you today. And I think even just the way you started to speak a bit about the seasonal nature of some of the different things that both of us look at as part of our research and the work that we do. I know we've spoken a bit about spring and the different ways that can feel as though it brings renewed hope and different forms of regeneration and blooming. So thank you for inviting me to be a part of this conversation, and thank you for the ways that you've shared about my work and introduced me.
No problem, Francesca. Francesca, you're just talking about seasons then, and it's currently September and we're recording this and we're going into autumn. What does that mean for us in terms of thinking and imagining going into autumn?
What does that mean? I think alongside the fact that for me personally, I find autumn and winter can be quite a difficult time. I think the absence of lighter days for longer, the different ways that the weather can do its thing. But I think although I can find it quite a challenging period for a number of different reasons, I also tend to think of it as a time of hibernation, or a time when there can be different forms of pausing and sort of dwelling, whether it's within a home space or with different people in your life. And as much as you can probably tell, spring is an especially heartening time for me as well as summer. I think this time of year can be especially contemplative and reflective. And maybe in relation to the sort of things we're speaking about today, it can mean taking stock and thinking about hopes for the months and years ahead, but also how this year so far has been and how that relates to a much longer past and much longer histories, including the different ways that people are trying to strive towards a world where there is much more of a sense of freedom and love and hope and care that is meaningful and anything but commodified.
That's so beautiful, Francesca. And like, I love the way you were able to make my question about autumn related to the book, because I do think it is. And I think that the fact is, you wrote this book, didn't you, in 2020? You wrote it during the lockdown and the first year of the COVID-19 global pandemic. And what I think is really amazing about this book, and like other scholarship we've had on the show that focuses on COVID-19, is it is like a return to what happened and what we were kind of living through, both structurally, interpersonally and culturally. And it really is shocking to like read back some of your analysis of how brands, we're talking here about clothing brands like Boohoo, delivery services like Deliveroo, like we're talking about your real kind of high profile, capitalistic, multinational organizations and how they capitalized off one of the biggest killers and disasters of the 21st century. I think that it's 2023 now, and returning to this kind of analysis and this work, I think is so important, because there's a very good chance that we'll be experiencing a pandemic again within our lifetime.
Yeah, thank you. I think exactly as you're sort of speaking about there, when sort of in the moments before we started to have this call, I was sort of reflecting to myself about, well, what was I sharing in the book, or what did I write at that time? And I feel as though actually the sense of time over these last 3 years in particular has been especially, whether we want to describe it as like warped or contorted or blurred in lots of different ways for lots of different people. But I think when I was reflecting on these last few years and just the ongoing nature of COVID-19 as well, I was thinking about how these conversations to do with this time before and this time after are continuing to unfold in these ways that brands are benefiting from. So sort of to your point, when you were speaking about some of the examples, whether it's fast fashion or delivery services, there have been so many messages around how people can try and maintain some sense of normality or return to a so-called sense of freedom that they might have felt before COVID-19. And I think even though we're in 2023 now, we're still seeing some of those messages being pushed. So whether it is sort of messages around retail high streets starting to flourish a bit more, and because people are now able to take part in forms of self-care, as it's sort of repackaged as, or forms of catharsis by moving through a physical shopping space. I think these ideas to do with, I suppose, normality and also people's ability to access forms of consumption, they certainly aren't specific to the COVID-19 pandemic, but what I feel we have seen is sort of an acceleration around some of that, and just the really explicit ways that brands are trying to present, or continuing to present, consumption as a way to access a sense of self-soothing, a sense of joy, a sense of pleasure. And more recently, as part of how I've been critically thinking about some of this, I've been doing some work alongside Emily and Ponzo, where we've been looking at different demands, displays and dreams of Black joy during times of crisis. So with a focus on how we've seen the joyful experiences and emotions and expressions of Black people being represented and sort of commodified by various commercial institutions who are completely disconnected from what Black joy can mean and the collective nature of it, and instead are trying to equate Black joy with Black consumerism, or equate Black joy with individualistic and sort of commerce-oriented consumption choices.
Just to bring the listeners into a kind of more practical example of consumption in COVID-19, like I was thinking as you were speaking of the images like on TV during the first sort of weeks of the lockdown, where people are kind of stockpiling toilet roll, like the queues to Costco, people like, what, as someone that specializes in consumer culture, capitalism, black feminism, black subjectivity, and just society more broadly. Like, what do you see as that telling us about our society, that moment when we see those images of intense consumption?
So I think there's lots of different things. I feel as though some of the first thoughts that come to my head is how brands can benefit from perpetuating fear. So perpetuating the idea that products and resources are scarce. And that's not to say that there aren't times when that does happen. You know, certainly there are times when shelves aren't stocked. There are times when people are rushing to stock buy something because the likelihood of them having access to it is diminished for a whole host of different structural reasons that relate to ongoing crises. But at the same time, we know that whether it's brands saying there's a sale, you know, get them whilst you can, or brands saying that you can't buy more than three of a single product, they will really push messages that can feed into this impulse to buy now because something is framed as not being there tomorrow or in a few hours' time. And I think something else that really comes to my mind is how the people who are working in those shops are treated and were treated at that time. And this maybe relates to some of the other different elements of consumer culture and the commodification of care that I look at in the book when I think a bit about higher education and some of the ways that universities both try to distance themselves from being perceived as a brand while actively participating in branding practices. And I'm speaking a bit about universities because I'm thinking of how the dominant narrative to do with work at that time was often this idea that everybody can and was able to work from home, whether that was as students, as staff, as individuals who learn or teach at university but might work in different ways outside of it. When we know that the people who were in shops dealing with the panic buying, dealing with the rush to stock up on a product, were dealing with a whole host of forms of harassment, mistreatment, abuse. They were at such risk of exposure to the virus itself. So I think the main thing at the forefront of my mind when I think of that period of time and I think of the ways that brands push consumption is the harm to the world as a whole, environmentally, socially, politically, sure, but also in particular thinking of the work and labour conditions by those that are faced by those who are working on those shop floors. And we know that these are roles that have historically been low paid. These are roles that are typically taken up by people who are impacted by the intersections of capitalism, racism, xenophobia, sexism, misogyny. So beyond consumption being harmful on a planetary level, I just think if we're going to speak about caring for other people and we're going to speak about togetherness, then what does that mean when it comes to addressing the impacts of consumption in relation to the work and labour conditions that people are left dealing with in the process of being expected to provide the products that people are demanding?
Yeah, that's so powerful, Francesca. And it's reminded me of kind of a section or a thread throughout the whole book where you kind of flip care on its head in that you talk about how obviously care being political and care being something that we have to intentionally understand and actually list through what we actually mean by when we're saying care, else it gets branded and commodified. But also I really liked how you spoke about those that are more likely to be positioned as carers, both structurally, interpersonally, and in their jobs. And like kind of thinking, okay, so what care is there for people that are supposed to be at the forefront of being carers? And like thinking about the sort of supermarket example, the supermarket workers example, like who's looking after those people? Because actually, when it came down to it, a lot of vulnerable people that have less access to support and care are entering the supermarket space during a lockdown. Everyone's going a bit mad. And you find that you've got people that were not necessarily in positions or jobs that were centered around care actually now being like, okay, I've got to look after this vulnerable person, getting their shopping. And that's just part of my role now.
Your question around how do we ensure that people who are carers in different ways are cared for is such an important one, and one that felt as though it was very much lost in a lot of the mainstream media and public and political discourse throughout all this. So I'm even just thinking about, you know, the whole clap for insert key worker group that was arbitrarily at the time referred to as key worker or essential worker, despite being.
Could you just explain what that was, what that phenomena was? Because obviously we're in 2023 now. I know people remember, but this is Surviving Society is an archive. So could you just explain what the clapping was?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I feel as though my initial thought is exactly what was that?
Yeah.
So I'm referring to the period of time when there were different calls for people to clap, whether it was to clap specifically in relation to showing appreciation for the work of individuals and roles that at that time were framed as key worker roles or essential worker roles. But often the conversation involved an emphasis on people working in healthcare and medical related roles. So there was a lot of discussion around the NHS, a lot of discussion around the work of nurses and doctors who absolutely should be appreciated for the work that they do. But the fact that this took such a surface level gestural form, like when we think about this in relation to the ongoing industrial action for people working in this space to actually be paid what not only what they are due, but paid what they need to live and exist in some cases. There's this complete contrast between the narratives we saw at the time, whereby the government was appearing to say we appreciate these workers, but we're only going to express this appreciation in the form of this gestural moment of clapping, and actually we're going to turn this expectation into this sort of demand placed upon people in Britain to express some form of British citizenship. I suppose I see this as being connected to expectations of dutifulness, this notion that to be a dutiful British citizen at that time was to take part in this gesture that does nothing to address the work and labour conditions of those people, does nothing to improve their pay, does nothing to ensure that they're provided with the protective equipment to mitigate the potential of them contracting COVID-19. So when I think of that moment, I think of it as symbolising so much about the state of British politics, which is that the claims that are made around supporting those who do provide forms of care are claims that are hollow at best and tend to amount to actions that are representational. They're symbolic, they're a clap, as opposed to addressing the structural conditions faced by those individuals. And I would also just add, when I think about that time and the way that we saw these terms such as key worker and essential worker crop up, I'm always so aware of the roles that were sidelined or were rarely discussed as part of that. So as we were speaking about a moment ago, individuals working in shops, working in supermarkets, you know, I didn't see the sort of similar calls to ensure that they were receiving acknowledgement and support. And I think that a lot of these discussions tell us a lot about the class politics that we're dealing with in Britain, and the fact that of the roles that tend to be perceived as key or essential, within those framings, there is a lot of messaging around what work is deemed to be valuable, and that tends to more often than not be work that is going to be associated with the lives of those who aren't the most marginalised. Yeah. You know, certainly that's not to say that there are people working in the NHS who aren't impacted by the intersections of classism, racism, sexism, who are working class, but it's to say that the British political environment created this hierarchy of work and labour that was incredibly oppressive, and certainly was a hierarchy that was reflective of the establishment and their values.
100%. And I feel like you name that quite a bit in the book around how, like, the crisis of COVID-19 and consumer culture was very much framed around the lives of middle class people. Like, how can we make middle class lives more livable?
Yeah, it is exactly that. I think even I've been reading some things recently to do with these ideas about togetherness or this idea of us, you know, all being part of a one that has been impacted by this pandemic. And it feels as though that togetherness is so contingent on being a certain way, being a certain people, having a certain background, having access to certain financial material resources. So yeah, like you said, one of various themes that I explore throughout the book is how ideas to do with white middle-class domesticity and family life seem to be at the forefront of quite a lot of media and marketing, and how those messages tell us a lot about norms in relation to work, labor, relationships, gender, and again tell us a lot about systems of valuable, who or what is deemed to be valuable, who or what is deemed to be part of this us that brands are representing. And more often than not, it's clear it's an us or it's a we that has spending power, that has disposable income, and that is an us that is framed as coming together through consumption, which is at odds with the sort of collectiveness that the world needs.
The critical analysis that is present throughout this book is very much centered around the limitations of representation and consumer culture in general to offer us any kind of hope of care and collectivism and togetherness. However, well, it's not however, in addition, is there some merit in having brands demonstrate or participate in kind of a structural literacy about society? Now, what I mean by that is middle class people that wouldn't understand, because they don't have lived experience of food insecurity or of issues around like care and sanitary care as well. Is there any merit in there being a kind of knowledge production around inequality that perhaps governments and brands participate in to quote unquote educate the masses? Like, what is the tension between a politics of representation and a kind of structural literacy? And I'm not saying that I necessarily think that's the case, but I think about times when there's kind of no representation, and it's not necessarily an either or, but like it's a tension that I feel like we're constantly, particularly as Black scholars, like grappling with at the moment.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I feel as though ultimately, there are so many different tensions there. So I've been thinking about this a lot recently in relation to, as we were speaking a bit earlier on, you know, Black joy and how different media marketing representations are trying to allude to that or trying to conjure up feelings related to that, but in ways that feel as though they ultimately serve, you know, a commercial entity, or they ultimately contort the reality of what it means to experience Black joy. And I think it comes back to what you just said there about moving beyond an either or. So I know that, for example, in this book, I speak about the fact that for me, brands cannot be activists. Brands aren't activists. And these terms have been increasingly used in quite interchangeable or at the very least blurred ways in recent years. But at the same time, and as part of...
Sorry, Francesca, it makes me think of, remember the Kendall Jenner advert?
Exactly.
With where she put like a flower on the police's Pepsi can or something.
Exactly.
Sorry,
exactly.
Carry on.
No, that, I mean, that's one of the key examples that I often come back to. And sort of what followed in the years after that has been really interesting, we'll put it, in terms of that sort of maybe like genre of advertising and marketing campaigns that very superficially try to connect to representations or rhetoric associated with particular social and political movements or community organizing examples or activist issues at the time. And yeah, I think that as much as in this book I make clear, you know, there are very distinct differences between brands and activists, within that book and as part of ongoing work, I've also been trying to grapple with the fact that in this contemporary world, especially when we think of the role of digital culture in the everyday lives of many people, and by extension, the role of social media, different forms of content sharing, different forms of self-representation, that means that within the world of community organizing, within forms of activism, within social and political movements, there can be times when branding practices or forms of media creation that are associated with branding are drawn on to an extent or are navigated and negotiated in ways that complicate sort of the binary of brands and activism. So to maybe come back to your point about these tensions, for me, in the work that I do, it's never about simply saying these representations shouldn't exist or brands should say nothing or do nothing. It's more of how can we critically engage with the representations that are out there, the brand strategies that are unfolding, the different ways that community organizing and activism exists and develops in the present day. How can we critically engage with all of that in a way that doesn't overlook these tensions that are always there? So to maybe provide a very particular example, within social and political movements, there are often individuals who become viewed as the face or one of few faces of it. And this isn't something that is, you know, new to the 21st century. You could argue that elements of celebrity culture or the cult of personality have been embroiled with forms of political and community organizing for a long, long time. And I think if we shy away from speaking about these things, what happens is we end up with these very simplistic perceptions of what brands are, what activists are, you know, what community organizing is, what advertising is. And if I was to sum that up in one sentence, for me, it's about recognizing the clear differences that are always there, but also critically acknowledging the fact that there are relationships between some of this, and those relationships aren't always as simple as brands being working in opposition to all social and political issues, or organizers working in ways that are completely detached from some of the activities of certain institutions that might be perceived as brands. I said that I'd simplify that in like a single sentence. No, I think it's a bit longer than that.
It's so powerful. You're always such a careful analyst, Francesca, and I think that that's right. Like, by having a critical gaze of these things, it helps us to delve into the politics of representation and what it means for people that are getting that representation but also still experiencing structures of inequality in such pernicious ways. And obviously things like the pandemic highlight that massively. One of the things that I think is just so amazing about the book is, returning back to what we were saying earlier, how you talk about normal and like the politicization of normal. And like thinking now, quote unquote normal, thinking now, like being in 2023, sort of over 3 years on from the pandemic, and the kind of ordinariness of life or the normality of life is something that particularly the middle classes have sort of strived to achieve, those in power strive to achieve. How do we get everything back on track, but quote unquote back on track? And obviously we're now living through a cost of living crisis, like food prices, fuel prices, everything is so expensive, like so much poverty in the UK in particular. Well, we're based in the UK now, but in the UK so much, and people are really, really struggling. And I guess it really kind of brings to the fore how difficult, or how, I mean, in many cases, like insulting, this brand activism is. Like, it was already pretty bad during the pandemic, but now when things are this bad, it's like, where is the kind of critical analysis? Where is the accountability of this kind of politics?
Yeah, where is it?
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Where is that accountability is such a crucial question in all of this, not only in relation to brands, but if we're thinking about political institutions, we're thinking about different organizations and throughout this process that have been making demands of individuals in relation to the pandemic, but have been sort of absolving themselves of any responsibility in terms of what they could be doing differently or what they should have done. And I think something that is still so jarring is sometimes I feel as though it's almost as if the last 3 years hasn't happened. In relation to some of the narratives that are being pushed by different brands, by different organizations, by different people. And what I mean by that is, of course, the last 3 years happened, but I feel as though the enormity of what has happened, particularly in relation to the many different forms of grief that people are still and may always be sitting with and dealing with, the space to really meaningfully recognize this beyond, again, these sort of gestural moments, like the temporary period of clapping or sort of, you know, a standalone single moment of memorializing. There's such little space for that. And I think in this push and rush to promote notions of normality, there's also been this complete glossing over of how this has impacted people emotionally, mentally, physically, as well as part of that, you know, these messages have often, particularly in recent times, you know, after we saw the lifting of lockdown measures and what was referred to as social distancing expectations, this push to return to physical spaces, to be in certain environments, that messaging was often really pushing actions that completely disregard the lives of those who are most likely to be impacted by the pandemic. So here I'm thinking about the ableist nature of expectations that people move around in certain ways, be in certain physical spaces where they're going to be exposed to potentially contracting COVID-19. And the fact that what's sometimes framed as a return to normal is actually a return to the comfort and convenience of those who have never been the most marginalized, and those who've often experienced comfort and convenience precisely because of the oppression and exploitation of other people. So where is the accountability is such an important question. I appreciate you asking that. And I think the unfortunate reality is, because of the state of British politics, the accountability doesn't lie with those politically in power. That's not me saying they shouldn't be criticised, because they absolutely should, but I'm not expecting to see any form of meaningful acknowledgement or any meaningful measures to address these matters anytime too soon, which is why the grassroots work of community organisers and just people working in ways to care for each other in their immediate surroundings is so, so vital. But we also know that that is often so unfunded, so under-resourced, and can exacerbate the forms of inequality that people are dealing with. So to maybe bring this back to the early conversation around who's caring for those who are caring, exactly who is, and in the absence of there being institutions that provide that care, we need to all be constantly thinking in collective ways about how care doesn't become individualized and something that's expected to be provided by a very small number of people who are then left without the care that they provide to others.
That's amazing. So inspiring, Francesca. And before we draw to a close, I wanted to ask you for some notes on hope and solidarity in times of crisis.
Yeah, so I think sometimes I feel as though people wonder where the hope in some of the things that I'm thinking about or reflecting on is, and it might not always be apparent in the ways that people expect, but for me there's always hope. And also for me, if there wasn't hope, then we wouldn't even be having this conversation.
Yes.
And there wouldn't feel a point to it. And there's hope for me in so many different ways. I think there's hope in the different forms of creating space and coming together that people are always doing, with an emphasis on allowing individuals to share openly and honestly. So here I'm thinking about you know, grief, people speaking about what has the past 3 years meant for you, like how have you felt, how might you have been impacted. There's hope in how individuals are critiquing the sorts of activities we're speaking about, are critiquing those brands, are critiquing those institutions, and are doing so in ways that are sustained, and are doing so also in ways that make clear we're going to try and hold you to account, but we're also not going to wait for you to take care of us. So we're going to, whether it's at a local level or even at the level of sort of within a household, we're going to try and find ways to care for each other that doesn't involve placing these impossible expectations on a single individual to be everything to everyone at all times.
Yes.
And yeah, right. And I think there's hope for me in also disengagement. And this is something, again, I think a lot about the work of Emily and Ponsa on Black disengagement. So this could include Black media disengagement, Black digital disengagement. And I suppose a very brief explanation of this is those moments when people turn away from a space or turn away from an individual, turn away from an institution and decide, actually, I'm going to spend my energy in different ways elsewhere. And I think it's so often there are conversations in British media and politics that try to frame the ways that Black people actively and intentionally disengage as mere disinterest, or will try and frame it as a lack of understanding of something. That's why people have disengaged from this media. That's why people have disengaged from the space. But disengagement can be active and can be powerful. And I'm always hopeful about forms of coming together beyond visibility and beyond the forms of representation that ultimately tend to serve the institutions that we've been critiquing today.
Mic drop. That's amazing. And I really liked the points that you said about how there are many of us who have been everything for everyone that are now stepping away from that. Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. being something that's good for both the people we're stepping away from, but also ourselves. Yeah, I really, really liked what you said there. And it definitely speaks true to me. And would that have happened prior to the pandemic? Maybe, but maybe just not as quick as it's happened now, because for me personally.
Well, thank you. And thank you for not just today, but for everything. Aww. And thank you, Surviving Society, for all that you do as well, because there are much longer conversations to always be had about the ways that your work is part of what's hope. So yeah, aww, big thank you and so much love.
Thank you so much, Francesca. And you can get the book, it's available now, Sage Publishing, the Social Science of Social Justice series. Absolutely amazing. You got to check it out. And the book's affordable and it's so good in terms of being an analysis of the last few years, but also brands, capitalism, and what is activism in general. So thank you so much, Francesca, and everyone get the book. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Surviving Society.
To support our work, you can rate,
review and subscribe.
To host or produce a series of Surviving Society,
get in touch with us via Twitter or Instagram.